The holographic brain. If there is an energetic duplicate of your body in the source field, wouldn't that mean your entire brain has a holographic duplicate as well? Maybe so. This raises an even more controversial question. If all the DNA in your brain has an energetic duplicate, then could this holographic brain somehow be responsible for at least a part of how you are thinking and functioning? Is a part of your mind working in a hidden, unseen, parallel reality right now as you read this book? Do you have a perfectly identical holographic brain that somehow interacts with your physical brain, using the DNA within every physical neuron almost like an antenna? These are intriguing questions. We've already given stunning new evidence to support the idea of an energetic mind in chapters 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, but now it's time to look at some additional biological research. In 1997, the New York Times reported that brain-damaged children actually improved their level of intelligence and physical coordination by having the entire hemisphere of their brain that was damaged, or should we call it the broken antenna, completely removed. If you lose half your brain, shouldn't you lose half of your memories and half of your ability to function? Apparently not. This finding astonishes even seasoned scientists. And according to Dr. Eileen P.G. Vining of Johns Hopkins University, who studied 54 different children who had the operation, we are awed by the apparent retention of memory and by the retention of the child's personality and sense of humor. This kind of extreme operation is obviously not an easy thing to persuade any loving parents to do, but it works. Johns Hopkins published a newer version of the same study in 2003, now involving 111 children who had the operation between 1975 and 2001, and showed that 86% of them became either completely seizure-free or at least no longer needed to take medication. Dr. Eric Kossoff explained what a seemingly miraculous effect this procedure produced. It's clear now that the quality of life of children with chronic, severe seizures greatly improves following the operation. In almost all cases, the children no longer depend on multiple medications, and postoperatively, most of the children are walking and running and living normal lives. In 1980, Roger Lewin published Is Your Brain Really Necessary? In the prestigious journal Science, discussing the work of Dr. John Lorber, arguably the world's top expert on a condition called hydrocephalus, or water on the brain. In these cases, cerebrospinal fluid backs up into the skull and builds in pressure with no way to drain out. In the most extreme cases, the skull can become almost entirely filled with fluid, leaving hardly any visible brain tissue at all. Many of these patients die or are severely disabled. Doctors now correct the problem with surgical shunts to drain the fluid, but in Lorber's time, this was not being done. Lorber studied a total of 253 hydrocephalus sufferers at the University of Sheffield in London. Of this group, 9 of them only had 5% of their regular brain tissue left, which would appear to be an utter and complete tragedy. Nonetheless, 4 of these 9 people had IQs that were greater than 100, and an additional 2 had IQs greater than 126. 6 out of 9 were fine, other than the fact that they were almost completely missing a brain, as we now think of it. Here's a direct quote from Lewin's paper about this astonishing phenomenon. There's a young student at this university, says Lorber, who has an IQ of 126, has gained a first-class honors degree in mathematics, and is socially completely normal. And yet, the boy has virtually no brain. The student's physician at the university noticed that the youth had a slightly larger than normal head, and so referred him to Lorber simply out of interest. When we did a brain scan on him, Lorber recalls, we saw that instead of the normal 4.5 centimeter thickness of brain tissue between the ventricles and the cortical surface, there was just a thin layer of mantle measuring a millimeter or so. His cranium is filled mainly with cerebrospinal fluid. Again, in case you didn't catch that, Lorber is saying the only brain tissue left was a 1 millimeter thick layer against the inside edge of the skull. According to Patrick Wall, a professor of anatomy at University College London, this is nothing new. Scores of similar accounts litter the medical literature, and they go back a long way. But the important thing about Lorber is that he's done a long series of systematic scanning rather than just dealing with anecdotes. He has gathered a remarkable set of data, and he challenges, how do we explain it? After this controversial study emerged, there was naturally a tidal wave of criticism. Dr. Lorber acknowledged that it is difficult to interpret brain scans, and he published a much more thorough study in 1984. He found that in the case of the math student who had an IQ of 126, fully 44% of his entire brain volume had been lost, and the rest of his brain tissue was compressed down into a super thin layer lining the inside of the skull. Nonetheless, he was happily enjoying a significantly above average IQ and had no trouble thinking and remembering information. This shows just how far our concept of thinking with the source field can really go. Luckily, no one has to suffer with this condition anymore, thanks to the surgical solution of installing shunts to drain the fluid. The same is not true for the animal population. Throughout Central Europe, many laboratory hamsters end up with hydrocephalus as a hereditary condition. In 2006, Veterinary Pathology Journal published a study showing that even the hamsters with the most severe forms of hydrocephalus, again where their brains are almost completely non-existent, still appear to be just fine. They do not show any strange behaviors or difficulties, and can act, think, remember, move their bodies, and breed in all the normal ways. It is fascinating to explore the connection between Gadeyev's DNA phantom and the idea of a holographic brain that is actually doing some of the thinking for us. If Gadeyev is right, and the DNA molecule really does capture and store light, then we should certainly assume that other scientists would have independently discovered the same thing. DNA stores, transforms, and releases coherent light. One of my favorite parts of The Field by Lynn McTaggart is her discussion of the work of Fritz Albert Popp, a theoretical biophysicist at the University of Marburg in Germany, who began making very similar discoveries starting in 1970. Although Popp did not discover the DNA phantom, his work ties in with Gadeyev's findings very nicely, and also adds in additional breakthroughs. Popp started out by examining one of the most deadly carcinogens known to man, technically called benzoapyrene. When he zapped it with ultraviolet light, he found that it absorbed the light, but then sent it back out at a totally different frequency. A very similar chemical, benzoepyrene, did not have this light scrambling effect. And unlike its deadly cousin, it was totally harmless to living organisms. Was this light scrambling effect the missing key to understanding what causes cancer? After Popp studied 37 other chemicals, some of which were carcinogens, he found that every single cancer-causing substance would rearrange ultraviolet light the same way. These deadly carcinogens consistently targeted the frequency of 380 nanometers. In fact, the only common link Pop could find between these various cancer-causing chemicals was that they all took in this 380 nanometer light and rearranged it to some other frequency. Obviously, this implies that 380 nanometer light is very important for our overall health and well-being. But if you never allow any sunlight to touch your skin without wearing sunscreen, you may not be getting very much of it, since sunscreen completely blocks ultraviolet light. Pop then learned that many biological lab experiments have proven you can destroy 99% of a cell with ultraviolet light, but if you then give it a very weak pulse of the same wavelength, it almost completely recovers in a single day. This is known as photo repair, and no one really understands why it works. To Pop's amazement, the best photo repair effects were already known to occur at 380 nanometers, even though none of these scientists knew anything about his discovery. Therefore, it appears that as the source field flows into our own measurable reality, its electromagnetic signature is the strongest at the 380 nanometer wavelength. The source field also has fluid-like properties, a very important point we will go into more detail about later on. This means you can create a rhythmic pulsation, or what most people would call a vibration, within the field itself, and get much stronger effects. Think about how Roman soldiers had to change the speeds they were marching as they went over a bridge in different groups. Otherwise, if they all marched at the same speed, the entire bridge would start shaking and could even completely come apart. All those little vibrations kept on resonating, and pretty soon, they would build up to much larger effects. The same thing applies to the source field, except that here, it's a good thing. So in the photo repair experiments, those weak pulses of 380 nanometer light apparently created a vibration in the source field that actually caused a much higher amount of healing 380 nanometer energy to start flowing in. This, in turn, bathed the dead cells with a splash of rejuvenating, life-giving energy in a short period of time, and they enjoyed a remarkable healing effect. Pop was hooked on the idea of finding out if the human body was indeed storing and giving off light. He challenged a student named Bernard Ruth to set up an experiment that could prove our bodies were giving off this light, in order for Ruth to finish out his PhD dissertation. Ruth was a skeptic and thought the whole idea was ridiculous, so Pop challenged him to disprove the concept instead. Ruth then went to great lengths to design equipment that could count light, one photon at a time. His device is still considered one of the best light detectors out there. Ruth's equipment was ready for the first test in 1976, and they decided to start out with cucumber seeds. To their amazement, the seedlings were giving off photons, and these light pulses were significantly stronger than Pop had expected. Ruth was skeptical and felt it had to be due to the presence of chlorophyll. So they switched over to potatoes, which do not have chlorophyll or go through any photosynthesis. Nonetheless, the potatoes gave off even more light than the cucumber seeds. Furthermore, their light emissions were extremely coherent, meaning they were highly structured, just like a laser beam's. Next, they tried hitting DNA with a chemical called ethidium bromide, which causes the molecule to unwind and die. Not surprisingly, the more Pop blasted DNA with this chemical, the more light burst out of it. This led Pop to conclude that the ability to store and release light was a key aspect of how DNA works, just as Gadeyev later discovered. Mainstream science still hasn't caught up with these breakthroughs yet, nor to how Gadeyev proved that the energy field responsible for storing this light isn't electromagnetic and doesn't even require DNA to be there for it to work. As Pop's research went on, he found that all living things were continuously emitting photons, ranging from only a small number to many hundreds. Interestingly, rudimentary animals or plants give off significantly more light, some 100 photons per square centimeter per second, than humans do, at only 10 photons per second in the same size area. This was high-frequency light, ranging between 200 to 800 nanometers, well above the visible range. And again, it was coherent light, just like a laser beam. Pop also discovered that if he shined light on living cells, they would first absorb it and then release an intense burst of new light after a brief period of time. He called this delayed luminescence. This is exactly what we would have expected to see after Garyayev's discovery that the DNA molecule stores light. Obviously, the DNA is doing something with the light, not just storing it indefinitely. This also fits in perfectly with Gervich's observation of the energy emerging from the tip of an onion, including the fact that the effect could be blocked by shielding off ultraviolet light. In short, our DNA apparently stashes away light as if it were a direct source of energy and vitality. If the DNA gets too much light, it sends it back out, perhaps like an organism might excrete waste products it no longer needs. However, unlike waste, Pop believed these light emissions were serving a very useful purpose. They contained information. Specifically, these light pulses carried the codes to reestablish order and balance throughout the body. Pop also found that we give off significantly more of these photons when we are going through stress, even though we are not taking in additional light. I consider this a very significant point. We know that many illnesses are enhanced or even caused by stress, and it could be that when we get stressed out or go through negative emotions, we're giving away some of our own vitality by shedding the light stored in our DNA all throughout our cells. Why do our bodies end up doing this? It appears that these extra bursts of light contain the information our cells need to heal themselves from all the damage we've been causing them through negative emotions. Therefore, in order to get healthy again, we're going to have to charge our DNA back up and get more light. This raises another interesting question. Obviously, the vast majority of our cells are not being exposed to outside light of any kind, other than the very top layer of our skin. So how exactly do we get more light? How does the light make its way through to the deepest, most internal parts of our bodies? Is all this light strictly coming from visible sources all around us? Obviously, we don't die if we are kept in a totally dark room, but our DNA clearly seems to be using light all the time. Indeed, could these photons be emanating directly out of the source field itself? And if the source field and its energy is fundamentally interconnected with consciousness, as the Russian pyramid research suggests, then could our minds and emotions be affecting how much light can get in and where it gets in? Do we have to be open to the source field in order for its healing effects to move into our bodies? Could this explain the placebo effect, where simply believing we will be healed actually helps us get better? In short, is it possible that our attitude determines how well our DNA and our cells can absorb light?